Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity has a new leader. We look back at the legacy of outgoing President Cardinal Walter Kasper and plundering the planet for natural resources, why the Church is keeping an increasingly close eye on the mining industry and its impact on local communities. The Vatican announced on Thursday, July 1st, that the head of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, is retiring from his job and will be succeeded by the former head of the Swiss Bishops' Conference, Bishop Kurt Koch of Basel. Bishop Koch, who also takes over as head of the Commission for Religious Relations with Jews, is a theology professor and has been a member of the Council for Christian Unity since 2002. On taking up this new appointment, he's automatically raised to the rank of archbishop. Meanwhile, after almost a decade as the Vatican's top spokesman on relations with the other Christian churches and communities, Cardinal Kasper leaves behind a significant legacy of progress in overcoming old prejudices and worshipping and cooperating more closely across the ecumenical divides. Earlier this year, his council organized a symposium to discuss the book Harvesting the Fruits, summarizing this progress and the key problems which still face those working on the front lines of Christian unity in the Catholic and Protestant worlds. Chief among his concerns, the Cardinal told me, is how to translate the important theological agreements into the everyday life of our churches.
Now we have 40 years of dialogue, the whole pile of documents, and we do not want that they become dusty in bookshelves, but that they are received in the living body of our churches. And so we made a summary in order to facilitate the reception process. And the second point is, now is a new generation coming up after 14 years. They have to take over the torch, and they should not start again from the scratch. We will show to him, well, we can achieve something by the dialogue, and we achieved a lot more than I thought before, and they should build up on this basis we have already reached. And for this reason, we did not only in a triumphalistic way say what we have achieved, but we identified also the open questions. And a question once identified is already half of the solution.
Cardinal Kasper, you also say that mistakes were made in the publication of the document Dominus Iesus. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that's a question of language all the time. It's a doctrinal language. Congregation for Doctrine of Faith uses normally. I could imagine a language which does not water down the doctrine, but is more acceptable, more accessible to the other churches. And this is, for me, the main lack. It's a Catholic doctrine which is expressed in this document, but it can be expressed in a different way. And especially, we should not always talk what the other do not have. So we should say what we have and what we have to give to the others, and what we that we expect also their gifts. And so I think it's more a dialogical style I would want in such documents.
You also know that it's often said there are varying views within the Vatican itself on this ecumenical question.
Yeah, of course we are human beings, and human beings have always different views. It's normal, it's not a weakness, it's a richness, and we are in discussion among others, but it's differences. These are differences on the basis of common Catholic faith, of course. But then we can have different options, different aspects. And this is the reason why I sent this document in the Italian translation to all superiors of the other dicasteries, and they were very hopeful. And also the Holy Father reacted in a very positive way. He quoted it even in his Catechesis of Wednesday. And so I think this document helps also in the Roman Curia.
Among among those acknowledging the retiring cardinal's rich legacy to the work of ecumenical dialogue was the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, who described him as a great theologian, but also a man of prayer and pastoral sensitivity. Notwithstanding the many challenges facing both communities today, the Archbishop said the cardinal's warmth and insights have always ensured that Anglicans feel welcomed in Rome as brothers and sisters in a common faith and mission.
I would very much hope that the kind of tack which Cardinal Casper has taken in the last few years will be continued.
As chairman of the Council for Christian Unity of the Church of England, Anglican Bishop Christopher Hill has worked closely with Walter Casper over the past decade. I talked with him about the legacy the Cardinal leaves to the new president of the Council for Christian Unity.
I would see his contribution in three ways. First of all, Cardinal Casper has brought a rigorous academic understanding of ecumenism. He's a scholar. He knows his stuff. He articulates it very fluently in several languages, certainly, of course, in German, but also very fluently in English. So he's a heavyweight academically, and that's been very, very important, especially in view of the academic theological dialogue between the Roman Catholic Church and the other Christian churches. Quite recently, he and his Pontifical Council have sponsored a symposium and indeed a book called Harvesting the Fruits, I think it was reported by you, looking at all the dialogues over the last few years, just seeing what we can actually harvest now. And there are some really important things we can do together, and he's taken seriously the theological side. That's very important. The second thing that I think I'd like to say is that he's brought his cheerfulness and his humanity and friendship to see, for example, Cardinal Casper talking with Archbishop Rowan, Archbishop of Canterbury, talking together as pilgrims together along the ecumenical journey. You can see, and I count a little bit of friendship, indeed myself, and friendship is very important, especially when there are obstacles along the way. One of those wonderful phrases that ecumenists use, the stormy waters of some issues to do with the ordination of women to the priesthood, issues in the Anglican communion about human sexuality, which have made the interrelationship of the churches, the Catholic Church and the Anglican churches and the Church of England, not always easy in the recent times. Friendship is very important. I think the third thing is that he, as a German, he knows about human reconciliation as well as a slightly narrow, more narrowly defined Christian reconciliation. And that's rather important. Also, he won't give up, because of his German background, on the Reformation and Counter-Reformation issues. For example, if I look back to another pontificate, John Paul II, with his Polish background, obviously looked at the East-West divide of Christianity, that great fault line going back to 1054. But Cardinal Casper, in his work, remembering the Reformation, Luther, a divided Germany, not that Germany was one then, but what is now Germany, divided up into prince states, some Catholics, some Protestants. And to not give up on the Reformation dialogue has been very, very important.
During his final press conference, Cardinal Casper here was talking about the difficulties experienced over the past decade, and you mentioned some of those. He talked particularly about the fragmentation of the Protestant and Catholic worlds over ethical and moral issues.
Yes.
How much of an obstacle do you see this right now? Where does the solution lie on this particular crucial question?
If anyone could see a straightforward solution to this, whether Cardinal Casper or the Archbishop of Canterbury, or indeed myself, we would be running with it. One of the problems, I think, is the fragmentation of not just ethical issues, but the mega-narrative of the whole of Western thought. It is not so different from the kind of concerns that the present Pope has, the Pope Benedict has, about, if you like, our postmodern divided cultures, particularly in the West. And I notice recent initiative in looking for re-evangelization in the northern and western world, because nobody has any more the great narrative. It's very difficult then, without the big picture of God and history, everything else becomes just what I want to do, and individualism. And that means that churches, and indeed the wider societies, are fragmented into a whole lot of atomistic individuals. So we have to, I think, go back to some first principles and see whether we are just lone individuals or whether actually there is such a thing as community. If there is such a thing as community, as of course a Christian, I strongly believe there is, and the church is an embodiment of a kingdom community, then one could begin to ask, what is for the common good? Not just what do I want for my personal satisfaction, development, gratification at the present time as an individual, but what serves the common good. I think once we can move into that sort of dialogue, then it won't solve all the problems, but I do think we will be on the way to having a key of interpretation to some of the very difficult issues which divide, if I may say so, all the churches down the middle, including the Roman Catholic Church. And I know there are official stances on, of course, a number of major issues, but there is also internal dialogue within and amongst Roman Catholic Christians, quite sharp, as there is within the Anglican churches, as there are within the Protestant churches.
Looking back over the past decade, Cardinal Casper's also talked about mistakes being made on both sides, which have slowed down progress. On the Catholic side, he's talked about documents such as Dominus Iesus and the recent announcement of the Ordinariate for Anglicans wishing to become Catholics, not in a question of content, but in a question of style and the way that these documents were presented. What do you understand perhaps by mistakes on both sides?
It's very, very easy to tread on toes. And if you don't know where the toes are, you need to talk to friends who'll tell you where they are. I think behind that, Cardinal Casper is talking about statements which and declarations which come out of one department within the Vatican, where rather more consultation about style, tone, language, take Dominus Iesus, the language of the uniqueness of the Roman Catholic Church. If there had been a little more attention to what I think Cardinal Casper's dicastery has been saying and doing over the last 40 years, then probably some of those mistakes could have been avoided. There is a department, Cardinal Casper's department, where there are friendships and contacts and day-by-day discussions with Christians right across the world of all the different Christian churches. And I think it's a pity when some of that experience is not more used or more sensitively used by others in the Vatican.
If you're looking perhaps at what he could be alluding to on the other side, what would you see there?
Certainly, from time to time, even in the Church of England, which has a good record of taking our dialogue with the Roman Catholic Church very seriously, we get shrill voices, sometimes decisions coming up at the most awkward and difficult times without reference to our ecumenical partners. And so in making that criticism of, the Vatican perhaps being a little more coordinated in its responses, I fully acknowledge that I'm sitting in a glass house throwing stones. We do the same. We take our internal decisions and sometimes don't think about their timing, the way they're taken, how that's going to sound within the wider ecumenical world or indeed amongst our other Anglican churches.
Finally, looking ahead, the new era, if you like, of ecumenical relations under the new bishop who's coming in, Bishop Koch, what do you hope for perhaps in the coming years? What would be your message to him?
Bishop Koch comes again from a good scholarly background and a German-speaking bishop from Switzerland. There is an existing ecumenical network in Switzerland, Catholic, Protestant, Reformed Protestant, and Old Catholic. So I'm sure he will bring some of those friendships and some of his own Swiss experience. I would very much hope that the signal that is being sent by having another German-speaking head of the Pontifical Council Promoting Christian Unity is that the kind of tack which Cardinal Casper has taken in the last few years will be continued, and I would have every hope and encouragement that would be the case.
My thanks there to Bishop Christopher Hill of Guildford, Chairman of the Council for Christian Unity of the Church of England. from jewellery to coins, from electronics to energy. The global mining and oil industries touch every part of our lives. The extraction of natural resources such as oil, gas, copper or coal is a central feature of modern economies. While globalization creates new opportunities and more competitive prices for consumers, it also imposes new burdens on poor and marginalized communities who witness the exploitation of their natural resources without enjoying any of the benefits in terms of profit or much-needed development projects. While there has been much greater awareness of these concerns in recent years, poorly governed or conflict-ridden regions, indigenous lands and untouched environments continue to be exploited, sometimes at great human cost.
If this is not managed well, you end up with people's lives being affected, their livelihoods being affected, and that builds into a fair amount of anger and sometimes violence.
Father Seamus Finn heads the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office for the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in Washington, D.C. He has a keen interest in ethical investment and corporate responsibility, working with other faith-based organizations to keep such ethical and moral issues on the agenda of governments, corporations and financial institutions. Following a recent visit to Zambia, Malawi and the Democratic Republic of Congo, he talked to me about the increasing importance of monitoring the mining industries and their effects on communities across the developing world.
Absolutely. Increasingly important, I think, for a number of reasons. The mining companies are scouring the world looking for minerals, looking for oil, looking for gas, whatever it is they're searching for, because the demand is very high and the price is very high. And so this is a good time to take advantage of a good return for them. I think, secondly, they've obviously developed a lot of new technologies, so that in many instances now they're able to reprocess something that they might have left aside 30 years ago. Or they have technology that's actually letting them get to places that they were not able to get to before. And there is a lot of competition. I think it's not only now that there is one company coming around looking to sign a contract with a government or with a region. They're coming from North America, they're coming from Europe, they're coming from Australia, and they're coming from China.
How much is the church able to engage with this issue? How much experience does it have, perhaps, in trying to really work on what are the issues regarding the local communities?
I think the church's opportunity, from my perspective, I think is twofold. I think, and maybe in the first one, we're doing some catch-up, beginning back with previous Holy Father. He did talk about, back as early as 1990, some of it in connection with his relationship with the Green Patriarch, Bartholomew. He did begin to talk about the ecological dimension of the Catholic vocation and did begin to introduce into some of his addresses different thoughts about ecology, the environment, the earth, and trying to also integrate some of the wisdom of, I think, the indigenous and the native traditions. And the present Holy Father has continued that. Perhaps, I suppose, what's lacking and what we still don't have is maybe a fully articulated vision of a theology of creation that fits within the Catholic framework. And by that I'm seeing we often make reference to human beings as being created in the image and likeness of God. But our reading of Genesis is also saying that the creation, all of creation, is a reflection of who God is, and it is the primary revelation of God to the world, is the created order. So I think we're beginning slowly to capture some of that wisdom, recapture it, because it's found in some of the great spiritual writers. And I think hopefully we can begin to present it and offer it to the Catholic faithful around the world. Because I think most of all, while we may not have technical solutions or actual scientific solutions on a number of these, we do need to present a vision that is informed by faith about natural resources. And I think that's a really important role that the church has. I think working with local communities, the church has lots of experience, whether it has to do with farming or whether it has to do with local microfinance, microcredit, crafts, all of that sort of stuff. So that experience is there, and I think we can bring that to the local communities in terms of bringing people together, getting them to take seriously, you know, what the issue is, being serious about collecting information and facts and data, and obviously trying to look for solutions to the challenges that a mining company presents when it comes into a local community. And I think you see many experiences of that across the world. lots of experiences of in Latin America where sometimes this has gone well and sometimes not so well. And so we've, you know, we had huge loss of life last year in Peru. So if this is not managed well, you end up with people's lives being affected, their livelihoods being affected, and that builds into a fair amount of anger and sometimes violence. And so how is the church able to, I think, create a climate and an environment where there can be some agreements between the company and the local communities and some modus operandi going forward? It's not maybe it may not always be possible, but at least one needs to be able to create the climate and the process.
In practical terms, you'd quite like to see some of the bishops coming together and drawing up perhaps guidelines or some kind of pastoral around this issue of natural resources, wouldn't you?
Yeah, our research suggests that a number of individual bishops, particularly those who have a mine or an oil company or a gas exploration company in their diocese, have written letters. I think my concern about that quite often is, and these are good letters, I don't want to dismiss the importance of it because they're offering guidance to the local community, is that it always begs the question about where the bishop's conference is on the issue, because natural resources, in a certain sense, are the patrimony of the entire country. And quite often they're controlled by the federal government or the sovereign government, and they're the ones that sign the contracts, they're the ones that collect the taxes or the tariffs or the fees. And quite often, they're not terribly responsive to the local community. And so, in one sense, you're asking the local community where the mine is to kind of bear the burden of the imposition of the mine, and the entire country benefits from the income or the taxes that are collected. And so I think it's important that a bishop's conference reflect, in terms of their own individual areas, about unnatural resources. And natural resources, as we all know, maybe in minerals it's a little, they're quite located, but natural resources have to do with, you know, mines, have to do with water, have to do with land, have to do with air. All of those things are quite, don't necessarily always respect boundaries. And so guidance, I think, is important at a national level. And I think it's important at an international level. I think perhaps the conferences and the dioceses of Africa can learn from the experience of Latin America, where there's been a lot more mining, and perhaps they've had the opportunity to learn. And so we're looking for, hopefully, that they might share some of their wisdom and their principles. And I think also, for me, in Washington, it is important at a global level, because we have some major actors like the World Bank, and like the international financial institutions and the international development institutions that are continually looking to improve their standards and their criteria. Are they going to invest in a specific project? Are they going to give a loan for the exploration of specific resources? So they're also looking for not only the value of the project, but they're also looking for both guidelines in terms of the social impact on local communities, the impact on the environment, the outcome for the people in the area, and the sustainability of the project.
Let's look a little bit at this impact on the local community. You talked about the risk of environmental damage. We've seen some worst-case scenarios, but what exactly is the most worrying impact, if you like, on the local communities of these kinds of projects?
Well, I think there are probably three or four, I think. I mean, the most immediate one, obviously, is that it's mines, by their nature, are very intrusive. It's not like building a small factory or opening a small shop. They're very big operations, and they take over huge amounts of land. And how they, you know, their transportation trucks and all the other heavy equipment that they use is quite intrusive in a local community. And so it changes people's daily lives in a significant way. Then, depending on what it is they're mining, obviously there are real concerns about, first of all, the normal concerns about dust and the impact that can have on public health, on people, on the quality of the air that people are breathing. And then I think another issue is, what is it that they're mining? I think it's a much different concern if you're mining ore for copper as if you're mining something in relationship to uranium. So that's a whole other level of concern. I think then, in the longer term, it's a question of, yes, you can have all these safeguards about how you're extracting the minerals, how you're processing the minerals. What are you doing with the leftover tailings, the leftover residue and the chemicals? What's the impact on the water? And what safety precautions have been put in place so that you can be looking at, if the wrong methods of disposal of the acid-treated product is taken, you can be looking at severe impacts on children 20 years down the road. that may, in terms of mercury in the water system, groundwater penetration usually takes a long time, but if the safeguards aren't there, eventually it's going to get into the water system. So those are real concerns, I think, that people in the local community have in terms of their own livelihood, their health, and the environment. There are lots of other concerns as well, I think, that are maybe more immediate, but you know, a mining company generally creates a lot of jobs when they first come into the area because there's lots of stuff to be done. And then there is a point at which all of the infrastructure is in place and many people have to be laid off because it's then back into just the operation of the mine. Much of it is quite mechanical. And that doesn't always create good feelings in terms of who retained their job and who lost their job. And some of these jobs in running a mine tend to be, you know, require some professional training. There's also a lot of migration issues. A mine is generally going to attract a lot of people into new people into the area who may be from the same, you know, region, but then it's also going to attract some people from other countries who are looking for jobs. And that puts a strain on the size of, depending on the size of the nearest village or town or city. Those are real demands on the local community. And in terms of its impact. And it often tends to take place rather quickly. It's not something that happens, you know, over a period of years. It happens over a period of months. So I think those are the most ones that come immediately to mind. And then I think how the mining community manages its relationship with the local community and how the local community relates to the mine is a process, I think, around which, you know, people have learned a lot. And so it's important to set up a mechanism where that conversation is open, is ongoing, is honest, is fair. Because obviously some people benefit more than others from this kind of industry.
Now, for years, we've heard how the conflict over precious natural resources in Africa has fueled conflicts. Mm. Is this still the case today?
I'd say it's still certainly the case in parts of the DRC. I think it's less so in a number of other countries. And I think it's a combination of events that have helped to move that along. I think maybe there are fewer open civil conflicts going on than what we had previously in places like Angola and the DRC and other parts of Central Africa. But they flare up occasionally. But I think also there's been a significant amount of pressure on the companies who produce cell phones, companies who produce computers, the end users of the actual product that's extracted from the ground, to do something. The customer is actually saying, look, I don't want to buy your cell phone or I don't want to buy your computer if I think you've got something, components in there or chemicals in there that, you know, have contributed to violence or loss of life or abuse in different parts of the world. So the companies are becoming more attentive to this and they're actually trying to look at the supply chain. In other words, do any of the material, any of the compounds, any of the stuff we are using here, when we actually buy it and pay for it, is it actually going to any paramilitary groups? And therefore, are they using it to procure arms? Are they using it to wreak havoc and hurt local communities? So I think there's a good amount of, some of those mechanisms are rather new, but there is certainly a significant amount of pressure by the companies on the supply chain to diminish, I think, for them at least to be clear that they are not using products that are contributing to violence or have been, you know, stolen from a local community.
My thanks there to Father Seamus Finn, head of the Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office for the Oblates of Mary Immaculate in Washington, D.C. And to find out more about this issue, you can go to the Confronting Global Poverty page of the U.S. Bishops' Conference website. That's www.usccb.org. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.